This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. What would you like to get off your chest right now? Are you feeling lonely, unappreciated, or misunderstood? When you keep these feelings bottled up, they can affect you negatively. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest and work through whatever is weighing you down. It's a great way to increase your self-awareness, change negative thought patterns, and more. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/beherenow today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/beherenow.
Welcome to Lama Surya Das's Awakening Now podcast. We are very pleased to share with you Lama's unique illumination of the Awakened Awareness teachings. If you are interested in supporting Lama Surya Das's podcast, please go to beherenownetwork.com/Suryadas.
Welcome, everybody, to the Awakening Now podcast. This is Lama Surya Das, the American Lama, and we're here on the Ram Dass-inspired Be Here Now network. Welcome. And today, I have a very dear and, dare I say, old friend, although he's really timeless, is Ken Wilber, perhaps the foremost transpersonal psychologist and thinker of our generation. And I assume you're somewhat familiar with his multitude of brilliant works, many works, and all of high quality. Although one could have many questions about them, and I will try to heckle some answers out of him. But Ken has all the answers, and I'm the question man. So, you know, there's hope for this interview. And Ken, thank you so much for coming on. I know you're probably in the middle of writing 5 books. Etc. Knowing you, what are you working on these days, and how are you, old buddy?
Doing well. I'm delighted to be here. Anything for you, my friend.
Thank you.
And I do continue writing like crazy. Yes. Some of the generic topics are central ideas that have interested you and I essentially our entire adult lives. And that is really, what is it that's involved in this whole process of waking up, of finding our higher, deeper, ever-present fullness, and what was at one point often called our highest potential. And it's both a potential and it's something that's, in a certain sense, ever-present. And so balancing these two sort of seemingly a little bit contradictory. They're actually just a paradox. But one Zen master put it that if in the Tao, if in our meditation practice, in our searching to manifest our Buddha nature or Buddha mind, if in the Tao there's any discipline, the completion of the discipline marks the destruction of the Tao. But if there is no discipline, one remains an idiot. So we have this, we're not really gaining anything. We're not creating a Buddha nature that we all don't have right now. And so if you use the Zen term and you have a Satori, then that is an actual event that happens. But one of the fundamental pieces of information that tends to come with that is that the thing that you're realizing is something that has been present all along. And in a certain sense, you've known it all along. So the Satori itself isn't really adding anything, but you have to have Satori to realize you don't need Satori. So that's a kind of a paradox of what we're doing. So you and I have been exploring this for a long time. And in terms of just the actual path itself, even though in a certain sense unnecessary, and like the Prajnaparamita Sutras say all the time, if you could only realize enlightenment is unattainable, then you'd be enlightened. So you got it. But that whole practice itself, the process itself, what helps that realization? What can make that go more effectively, more comprehensively? And we keep finding that there are new areas that we have to keep exploring, that as profound and important and absolutely central as the core of the great spiritual traditions are, we do keep learning new stuff. And that tends to at least help flesh out and expand in certain ways our own capacities for realization and the depth of our realization, what it is that we are bringing forth or manifesting. And you just even give a really simplistic example. Most of the great spiritual traditions have some idea of things like defiled emotions or the emotions that are negative and that can tend to obscure our already enlightened nature. And then many of them have profound ways, certainly Tibetan Buddhism, for transforming those negative emotions, those defiled emotions. So you can take anger, and if you go into it with a pure awareness, you can transmute it into its corresponding transcendental wisdom, its divine clarity in that sense. But one of the things that the traditions didn't have as good an understanding of is the stuff that, starting really only about 100 years ago, people like Freud and his inner circle of Alfred Adler and Carl Jung, Otto Rank, and these folks were actually studying what happens when you take an emotion, negative or positive, and you actually dynamically repress it. You actually seal it out of awareness. So that even if your awareness can expand in a type of ultimate unity consciousness, if there's this brick wall put up against that emotion, then that's not automatically going to get released. And so we do have to, and of course, many of the modern approaches in this country do attempt to combine a meditative practice with some sort of psychotherapeutic component or aspect. And that's certainly something that you've looked into. And that just continues to be one of the major concerns of my own work. And one of the reasons I call it integral is it's an attempt to take what seem to be really important fundamental issues. Centrally is the simple actual path of waking up itself. But then we have these other sort of adjunct areas like cleaning up or psychotherapeutic stuff. And then the things that we've learned from modern developmental psychology that you really can't see by introspecting. And so virtually none of the great spiritual traditions have an understanding of those. And we call those aspects growing up. But just keeping an eye out on how all of those are important. That's sort of one of the major things that I continue doing. And I did about four books have come out in the last couple of years on one was called The Religion of Tomorrow. And that was looking at a fully comprehensive spiritual system. Then we take all of these factors into account in terms of helping us wake up to our full and complete potential. And then I did one little sidetrack of a book called Trump and a Post-Truth World, which was looking at that from all of these larger perspectives and finding something hopefully interesting to say about that. Yeah, I don't spend a lot of time thinking about that particular issue, but there was so much commentary on it, I figured I'd jump in and say a few things on it.
No, that was welcome. You know, Your Religion of Tomorrow came out a couple of years ago, so it's already like yesterday. So I'm interested in awakening and nowness awareness, the specialty of Dzogchen, which therefore I have to ask you, so what is the religion of tomorrow today? Or what is the religion or the really the awakefulness, you know, the way of awakening today? And in the new now has gotten pretty old. People have been talking about it again for a long time. So how do we keep it fresh? And I strive to ride the crest of like surf or ride the crest of the breaking wave.
Right.
This moment, every moment, only moment. And you coined, I believe, with my desultory research, very minimal, I think you coined the term in our time, always already, meaning always already perfect, which is consonant with Advaita Vedanta and non-dual traditions like Dzogchen and non-dual Mahamudra.
Right.
We see it as absolute and relative as being complementary before you use the words contradictory. So for some of our listeners, you know, these Zen conundrums and all really are meant to break down the habit of over-relying on thought, not being anti-intellectual, but to go beyond the conceptual mind into the intuitive mind, the spiritual mind, beyond the mind, the heart mind, pure wakefulness. Any word fails, but it is a sweet. So I think this always already combined with some notion of character development or mentioning up or psychological awareness, skeletons out of our closets, and of course not doing that spiritual bypass where we roll the unwanted parts is very important. And since you coined that phrase, and I often hear criticism of you about that because people say in the old world, I grew up spiritually in India and so on, in Himalayas, so Ken doesn't talk enough about the relative practices, how to mench up character development, developing the virtues like generosity or humility or patience. I think patience, paramita, is the most important of the 10 panacean virtues of the Bodhisattva. Patience, shanti, which also means acceptance, tolerance, peacemaking. So what are your thoughts on that? And you've wrote a book, I believe, and I know you've talked about the fourth turning of the wheel, meaning your evolutionary dharma. And of course, Dzogchen is, and Mahamudra is called the fourth turning of the wheel in Tibetan. But I won't,
I understood.
Heckle you that about now, because maybe your book needs to call the fifth turning in its next edition.
Yeah. Yeah.
Evolutionary enlightenment is not a concept that the East has easily heard, I assure you.
No, that's true. Well, I have addressed, one of the things that is, I think, helpful to keep in mind is many of the great paths of enlightenment, paths of waking up, do make a distinction in what they call the two truths. There's ultimate truth and there's relative truth. And ultimately, of course, they maintain that those are not two. So they ultimately can't.
Right. It's like yin and yang, one within the other, light and shadow.
You're right. But it's also the case that we can see some distinctions between those. So for example, if you go back a couple thousand years to some of the people that were having some of the first fully realized, fully deeply awakened, and I'll just call it Satori, just
yeah, that's fine. Breakthrough.
But there was a time where a lot of the original people having these satoris, one of the things that happens with satori is that you lose that sort of sense of solidarity of everything being fixed and stable, and it becomes a kind of transparent openness, and it's just as important. There's no longer any fundamental separation between you and everything that's arising. And so that really is make me one with everything. So what would happen is you could be you could have this kind of satori 2,000, 3,000 years ago. But if you thought the earth was flat and you had a satori, you'd still think the earth was flat. It's just, you'd be one with it, but you'd still think it was flat. And you'd also look up and you see the sun, and you would think that the sun's going around the earth. So the point is, ultimate truth doesn't necessarily change a lot or give you a lot of information on relative truth. Mm-hmm. So you can have a satori, won't tell you anything about atoms or molecules or cells or any of that, won't tell you anything about evolutionary unfolding. So, but these are still important realities. And certainly the case when it comes to, on the relative side of the street, the types of things that have a direct impact on our own awareness, our own sense of identity, our own particular virtues, our own particular positive capacities. Yes. And those are important. And actually what I've done is try to expand the number of practices that we need to include with our ultimate awakening. So even if you come to the 6 to 10 paramitas in a book that I just recently done called Integral Meditation, I looked at things like stages of developmental psychology and looking at those, because you don't find those in any of the great spiritual systems. And then I looked at also the possibility of multiple intelligences. Now, we do have some indication of that in the traditions, but this is some very, very specific types of information that's coming along. And what it's saying is you can take your enlightened awareness, but it can be expressed through upwards of a dozen different types of intelligences. And again, simply having a fundamental satori doesn't necessarily make you an expert in all of these other multiple intelligences. And then I included the paramitas as examples of multiple intelligences. And then what I added was, instead of just sort of looking at the paramitas and saying it's important to include those, which I absolutely think it is, it's also important to realize that using Western developmental psychology measures, we can actually measure the relative growth in people as they move through each of those paramitas. Mm-hmm. So I'm not by any stretch trying to say we don't need that. I'm actually adding more detailed aspects of understanding that, so that can actually help us move through those and guide ourselves and guide each other, understand
the process also, and guide ourselves and each other. And not just think it depends on a Zen master or somebody hitting us on the head with a stick or a lightning bolt. But
yeah,
refine our process of evolving and awakening, and also integrating and being down in our body and in the earth and so on.
Right. Well, those are, of course, as we take some of these traditions, move them into a new culture. And this started in America, particularly in the 60s, part of the revolution in the 60s, and then you were at that period off doing one of the most complete and extensive and authentic and genuine spiritual searches that I'm aware of. I mean, you basically have met, you know, almost every one of the great living spiritual teachers across traditions, and you didn't just run into them, you took them all seriously. I mean, you actually tried to incorporate what you learned from each of them. It's extremely impressive what you have done. I've always admired that. And I'm also especially glad that you are becoming even more personally sharing of some of these interior events that you've gone through, because you are a truly a living monument of various types of spiritual wisdom. And so I think it's incredibly important what you're doing. I don't mean to slobber all over you and all that, but I just...
No, thank you, but I appreciate that. And I'm hoping to be put as a living monument next to Trump on Mount Rushmore. But I do want to say, I appreciate what you're saying about being more personal and making it my own, and also more open about my own background and visions and spiritual awakenings, right, and things. Partly so because it's true, and I'm 68 now, and it's time to tell my truth and then go away. And also, you know, back to the forest floor, like a mushroom upturned in the forest when I'm ready to go. Right. But partly also so people can understand they can do it too. This is not just something from ancient times, that if I can do it, you can do it. Anybody can do it. And right, it's possible today. Even like my jokey title, I think it was my last book probably. Who can remember? Awake, Make Me One With Everything.
Right.
It's of course the punchline of a joke, and we're not going to go into that now, and everybody's heard it, but I want to say really what got me to do that was, it was spring and I was walking in the woods here in Thoreauville near Walden Pond, but just because I live here, not because, you know, it's more sacred than anywhere else. It's just got a great,
right,
vibe and history to it and lineage. But I felt like spring, that the earth was growing up through me, like chlorophyll was glowing up through the green plants, reaching right for the sun. The right spiritual chlorophyll of bodhicitta, or of way-seeking mind, as they call right it, was, you know, like the earth was also growing up through me.
Right.
And I was part of it and one with everything. And right, not one just all mixed together with a Cuisinart, but in the great diversity of it all, the unity of the diversity.
Right.
And that inspired me also to talk more about a little my own experiences, not just with the great masters, but visions or awakenings, or feeling the whole body is my universe, and all is the whole universe is my body, and all beings are my heart, mind,
right,
things like that. And it really changed my natural activity relating to others and to the world as not other,
right,
through their eyes as well as my own, feeling what they feel. You know, right, people talk about mind reading, but I found if you stop your own mind and chatter, you see the other's minds moving much clearer.
Absolutely.
It's like, you know, when your children are lying to you because you've got a, you know, bigger mind and more experience, it's hard for them to fool you.
Right. Now, in that book that you mentioned, Make Me One With Everything, you actually mentioned in that book that up to this point, you did have a kind of, in a sense, in keeping with the Tibetan tradition, a little bit of a reticence about talking about personal,
yes, interior experiences. My experiences. Yeah.
But that you had on reflection and over the years, you had decided to start opening that up. And that book was kind of a statement that was a little bit of a shift in your approach, not in your fundamental ideas, yeah, or principles, but just in the presentation of them. And then in that book itself, you go through a large number of areas that were particularly involved with personal types of practice. You go through the yoga of relationships, you go through Tonglen, you go through now presencing, you talk about just that, being one with everything, and how that fundamentally shifts your core sense of who and what you are. And of course, that's that fundamental, absolute, ultimate truth that doesn't change. And that it doesn't evolve. It was present at the Big Bang. It was present a billion years ago. It's present today. That's what doesn't change. And what does change is the relative manifestations as it continues to express itself and unfold. And so what we have to do is indeed make sure that which is emptiness is not other than form, and that which is form is not other than emptiness. And while the emptiness is ever present, the form continues to unfold and evolve. And that's what we have to kind of keep up with. And so even Buddhism itself continued to sort of track its own unfolding, hence first turning, second turning, third turning, fourth turning. And yes, by the way, I actually said fourth turning belonged to things like Vajrayana and Tantra. So that's important. And in a sense, that's what both of our lives has been doing, is try to take, you know, what are those fundamental, unbelievable treasures that we've been given, and then how do we make sure that we don't lose them? And one of the ways we don't lose them is by keeping up with the evolving form in which it must appear, and in which it must be attractive to. We must have something that people want as we go forward.
And can relate to. I think that's the purpose of the different turnings. That's why evolutionary enlightenment stands up as an analysis. It's not like it was all there at the beginning, all clear and explained. Right. The ultimate has always been there, but in the relative, it's exactly evolving in the different turns, meaning the different cycles of narrow path and universal path, and then moving from purification more to transformation, then to transmutation, then to natural liberation or automatic liberation, as some new translator called it. I like that.
Right. Yeah. That is,
you know, like waves automatically liberating themselves as they roll.
Yes. Yes.
Not having to be ironed out.
Right. Right. Yeah. And one of the ways, it's a loose kind of metaphor, but it's one of the ways to think about it, is particularly if we sort of look at one of the components that a realization of emptiness can help bring to a person, is a sense of vast freedom and absolute liberation from all constraints. Yeah. And the constraints come from the limited identities that you have, you know, this self versus other. As Upanishads say, wherever there's other, there's fear. So we have all of that, you know, self-contraction, egoic fear, dukkha, suffering. And then when we realize that pure radical emptiness of all of that, there's a deep, deep freedom in being released from those limitations and constraints and dukkha and suffering.
Yeah, it's a huge relief.
Yes, relief, absolutely. Relief. But then there's also the flip side of that, is that where not this, not that, we're free of this, we're free of that. And then when we become one with that, the flip side of it, then emptiness is not other than form.
Yeah.
And so there we become, it's not so much freedom as it is fullness. And both of those, of course, are important. But the freedom, because emptiness per se, the ground, Buddha nature, doesn't change, then a person that would have a fundamental realization 2,000 years ago, and a person that would have that realization today, they're both equally free. One isn't more free than another. But because the world of form keeps evolving, that world keeps getting fuller. So a realization today is not freer than a realization 2,000 years ago, but it is fuller. There's more of the manifest world than there ever was before. And so that make me one with everything, the oneness stays the same, but the everything gets more complex. And so it really does. On the one hand, it really is always already. And then the other hand, and that keeps manifesting itself.
Yes.
The damn shadow.
Well, that's the joy. You know, that's like the joyous meditation. That's like the joy of creativity. That's like God delighting in just, you know, dancing and expressing herself. So I'm all for that. And that is the, like, I think somebody called the tantric distinction, rather than avoiding or purifying, it's all part of it and everything is it. And what did Ginsberg sing? Holy, holy, holy.
Right.
And holy, holy, holy. And everything is holy.
Right. I'm just as it is.
Down with that. He was very awoke. You've talked about levels and stages and a few other things that, you know, you've brought to the culture. It's very challenging for many people when you say, like, enlightenment today would be deeper or broader or more complex or more
right.
penetrating. Of course, people talk about the prophets and the saints as if it all started with them and, you know, it's all downhill from there. But there is another side to this. There's definitely another side to this, isn't there?
Well, sure. There are a lot of things that as history continued to unfold, and in some ways, evolutionary trends continued, so that we do see increasing positive things coming into existence. But that wasn't the whole story. So we also tended to lose things that were truly important. And in that sense, even though things are becoming more complex, like technology is becoming mm-hmm. more complex and information transfer. Right. All of that's becoming much more complex, but there are
faster,
aspects
that quicker
news, yeah. And that's a problem. So we want to, and that's one of the things that has, I mean, really one of the biggest concerns that I've had since I actually first found out about the various paths of the Great Liberation. Almost all the religion that I got as I was being brought up was typical, almost mythic, literal, fundamentalist Protestantism. I got religion if I believed that Moses really did part the Red Sea, and if I believed Lot's wife really was turned into a pillar of salt, and if I believed the one and only son of the one and only creator of the entire universe was born of a biological virgin, et cetera, et cetera. And then when I was around 17, 18 years old, I ran across D.T. Suzuki's three-volume set, Essays in Zen Buddhism. And I read it, and I was stunned. There was this thing called Satori. There's this thing called awakening. This is what religion was supposed to be about. And for the next 3 days, my primary response, it should have been absolute exaltation. It was rage. I was enraged, like 3 days straight. And I was so pissed because I kept saying, why didn't anybody ever tell me
this? I know.
It was unbelievable. And then my concern from then on has been, how do we make sure that that type of treasure not only doesn't get lost, but how it can indeed become more a part of a type of cultural wisdom that we would have? Because that fundamental mythic, literal stuff, that just won't work. And almost no educated person believes that. If you take a poll, Northern Europeans, for example, the percentage of them that believe in standard Orthodox Christianity and the mythic literal components, in the Middle Ages, about 95% of the population believed that. Today, Northern Europe, it's 11% of the population believes that. Religion.
That's a total three-year ground shift.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's not the norm. It's the abnorm.
Right. No. And part of my point about if we really are going to have a religion of tomorrow, something's going to have to happen. One of the things that's going to have to happen is that we make those waking up realizations central to what religion does. I mean, Lord, Christianity, as you well know, when it first started out, the first century or so, it was mystical experiences everywhere. Mm-hmm. The main concern of the New Testament is that it was written in Greek. And so the word was metamorphosis, enlightenment, awakening. That's what they were interested in. By the time the
Catholic... So what happened?
What?
So well, what happened?
By about...
The three question. Seven. And what's happening now of the same kind with this newly discovered Eastern wisdom or et cetera?
About 3 centuries later, as the Catholic Church became more the sort of codified institution that it was, it started to take all of those individual personal enlightenment experiences and converted them into their mythic literal correlates. So you had things like the Nicene Creed, the Apostles' Creed, and that was just a list of myths that you had to believe in. And so if you believe in there's the Father, the Son, the Holy Spirit, and then all of the other myths that are taken to be true, And if you woke up one day wanting to become a Christian and went out and found a local bishop, there would just be a list of things. You could read it, say yes, sign it, bottom line, because you, and now you're a Christian. Whereas previously, what you'd do is you'd go out and you'd find a teacher who was enlightened. The word was sanctus, who was sanctified, who had this metamorphosis. As St. Paul summarized it as, let this consciousness be in you, which was in Christ Jesus, that we all may be one. Now, that's how you became a Christian. You had to have that realization. And if you had that realization, then you were sanctus. You were actually sanctified and enlightened and awakened. It might take you a year or two or three of practice to actually have that happen. But then as the church takes over and says, nobody comes to salvation except by way of Mother Church, then Mother Church had a list of beliefs that you had to buy. All you had to do was buy those beliefs, and that was it. That's why I say you could become a Christian in one day at that point. Whereas previously, you'd actually have to find your own Christ consciousness that would make you one with everything. That's how you became a Christian. And fundamentally in the West, it hasn't changed that much. That's part of the problem. Of course, as you know, there are a couple of smaller branches of Christianity that do have contemplative mysticism, and they're still working for a realization of their own Christ consciousness. But that's not what religion in the West means to most people, and that's a problem.
It's unfortunate we don't hear that kind of preaching about what you quoted from Paul about that your consciousness be one with the source consciousness,
right,
and so on. And of course, that's what we're all about in our Western Dharma movement, not to mention the Buddha within and, you know, the great perfection. And
absolutely.
You know, and like you, growing up Jewish, I never heard about Jewish mysticism, Kabbalah, or met any saints, nor was there any direction or energy or aspiration toward that in my Hebrew school and bar mitzvah training and other things. So, of course, I sought that elsewhere as the spiritual chlorophyll or the way-seeking mind, the bodhicitta, was rising in this kind of plant. But so what's happening today? What's ossified and what are we stuck with? And how can we break right through to another dimension and get out of the flatlands into the three and four dimensional, you know, spiritual world, and not just be like a lunar asparagus only developing on one plane, like trying to sit longer. I know many meditators who are trying to sit as long as possible and think as little as possible. And that's like looking at the sky through a straw, as far as I'm concerned.
Right, right. Well, one of the things that does seem to be happening is that there are a relatively modest but significant number of teachers such as yourself. And I would like, I think of myself more as like a pandit, not so much as a guru, but there are those of us who are centrally interested in putting what's really crucial in spirituality back into spirituality and make sure we get that. And that is that fundamental process of metamorphosis, of transformation, of waking up, which is the realization of ever-present great perfection. And that is good. And I think, again, my version of if religion's going to survive into tomorrow and doesn't become less than 11% and then 5% and then 0%, is that it has that kind of core, that kind of waking up process. So that's important. At the same time, the typical fundamentalist, mythic, literal belief systems, those are becoming less and less influential as people become more educated and find that they just don't buy those literal myths anymore. They don't think that the Bible is the absolute word of God and it can never change and it's all literally true and empirically true and all of that. And probably one of the biggest kind of movements we see, and I think there's good news and bad news in this, is that because so much of Western religion was, number one, it was leaving out waking up, And then number two, when it came to the relative side of the street, it was coming from relatively low stages of growing up. If you look at like James Fowler's work on, again, this is how you think about spirituality. It's not your direct experience mm-hmm. of spirituality. That would be waking up. But then when you come up with theories about it, you think about it, you have your everyday beliefs, you think about what your ultimate concern is. Those are one of multiple intelligences. Mm-hmm. And so they grow and evolve through various stages. And if you look at the work of James Fowler, for example, he took thousands of Westerners and tracked, when he asked them about what's your ultimate concern, what's your idea of spirit, he found that it went through, like almost all the other multiple intelligences, they all developed through around five, mm-hmm. six, seven major stages of development. And you can have a waking up experience with any of those stages. Those are relatively independent. But our religious orientation, culture-wise, is still at, well, one of the ways to name these stages of relative spiritual intelligence that Fowler tracked was archaic to magic to mythic to rational to pluralistic to integral. And so the major dogma of the mythic schools of religion isn't even a very high form of spiritual intelligence. Mm-hmm. And so we have almost no waking up and very low growing up. It's two kind of disasters. So one of the things that we start to see happening a little bit more, which is important, is increasing teachers like yourself that are including waking up and putting that back into the mix. And of course, we have Christian mystics that are doing that, and Father Thomas mm-hmm. Keating and so yes. on. I think that's really important. On the other hand, because so much of our spiritual orientation has been so, had these dual deficits, had almost no waking up and very low growing up. Because of that, a lot of the best and brightest, the most highly educated, the pioneering scientists and medical researchers and environmentalists and all of that, they would start to notice one of the things that they were seeing increasingly in their disciplines is that they started to talk about unified, interwoven realities, not just separate atomic things and events, but whole systems where everything was interwoven with everything else. And this, of course, sounded to them like what the great mystical traditions were saying.
Yes. Interconnectedness
and so on.
Indra's web.
Yes.
The cosmic web and so on.
Yep. And this should go back to things like the Tao of Physics or mm-hmm. Deepak Chopra's works. Now, the only problem, and quantum mechanics seems to be the thing that everybody looks at, and the general notion is that quantum mechanics proves mysticism, proves that everything is interrelated. Now, it's not that I'm against that kind of stuff. But there is a major, major difference. And that is, with the real waking up practice, you have to take up certain exercises, certain practices. It might be mindfulness, it might be Tonglen, it might be tantric visualization, mm-hmm. whatever. But these are all first person changes that you undertake mm-hmm. to actually literally change your consciousness. Whereas if you study something like quantum mechanics, that's a third-person string of mathematical symbols. And so you can learn that, but it's not fundamentally changing your consciousness. It's not a practice that's going to give you a satori, no matter how much quantum mechanics you study. The same is true of any of the other interwoven sciences that we have, and they're all becoming sort of interwoven because the relative mm-hmm. world is interwoven. But that doesn't necessarily give you an actual waking up experience.
But well, that's why we like to stress the experiential and the transformational. And of course, it's no news to you or anyone listening that people today are not voting for or excited about religion unless it's about, you know, the Pope and pedophile priests and all. And straightening that out a little bit.
right.
institutional and cultural level, which of course has to happen. But people are saying, you know, I'm spiritual, I'm not religious,
right.
or just, you know, I have values. I want to pass on values to my kids, but where can I take them? Right. So I'm thinking a lot about this, is how we can bring this more in the mainstream. The mindfulness movement is doing a good job bringing it into the mainstream, although it's extremely utilitarian rather than transcendent or transformation oriented.
Right.
It's like, you know, daily mental floss is good for hygiene.
Yeah.
So a little mindfulness every morning is good for your mental hygiene, but it's not necessarily going to transform your world and your life. That's right. The Eightfold Path or all the different tantric or other kinds of practices. So how can we wake up today? How can we pass these things on? Timeless wisdom seems like an endangered natural resource. There's not much incentive, you know, material incentive to drive the capitalistic machinery to dig it up, mine it, refine it, explore it, and so on,
right.
Except in the corners of academia or ashrams and meditation centers. The neuroscientists are getting on the bandwagon, like you were mentioning, the quantum mechanics,
right.
the Tao of physics, that's old. Now it's the new neurodharma of the neuroscientists measuring the brain waves with their fMRIs and all. But I get the same flavor there a little bit of using science to prove the dharma when we can at the same time confirm or prove the message ourselves by doing a little practice, even just in a few years, as you said. If Christians can transform their consciousness to the Christ consciousness in a few years, why can't we?
Exactly.
I mean, I'm into the Riz, not just the Buddhas. I love the risen Jesus, you know, or anything that's rising. It's all awakening. It's all blooming and blossoming.
Right. Well, that's what we have a couple of problems. And one of them is to get the message out that, for example, that I got when I first read the essays in Zen Buddhism.
When you were 17.
Yeah.
Not a bad start.
I was stunned. And then after I was enraged, then I was ecstatic. I had, my God, this is what I'm going to start doing this. And I really did. I mean, you know, it said, like you, I started a genuine quest. So one is that on a larger scale. And what I mean by that is so many people, when you say, oh, you're religious, this is what religion is about, people have a very specific idea of what that is. And it's not waking up. It's some mythic belief. Oh, you have to believe that you have the one and only way to think about ultimate God or reality. And if you're Muslim, then you have to believe that Muhammad was the one and only, you know, greatest
prophet.
And if you're Christian fundamentalist, you have to believe you can't get this awakening unless you accept Jesus Christ as your own personal savior and so on. So most people have something like that in mind and they don't make distinctions. So it's for that kind of generalized thinking, what, let's say, Osama bin Laden was doing with his religion, and what Father Thomas Keating is doing with his religion. Yeah. They're both just that religious stuff. And, it's just, we've got an extremely broken, limited, narrow version of what religion is. And that's one of the main things that we have to sort of change by pointing out, well, wait, there is another type of religious engagement. Yeah. And that's often what people mean when they say, I'm spiritual, but I'm not religious. This means they don't buy all of those religious myths and dogmas and orientations, but they do want this sort of more personal awakening spirituality.
Of course. And people are seeking. People are still very much seeking. So I'm interested in you know, holding the space for that seeking, whether they're so-called beginners, which I don't entirely believe anyone is, and or, you know, more experienced, and so that we can awaken together. And I think that's very important these days, going from me to we, and not just self-help and self-development, but you know, universal awakening, and we're all in this together.
Right.
I since you mentioned Father Keating, the master of Christian centering prayer, and I should say for those that are listening, the late Father Thomas Keating, and do look up his book, Christian Centering Prayer, etc. I was invited to see him, let's say on his deathbed, to be dramatic, but it is true. And I was at Spencer Abbey in Massachusetts here a week before he breathed his last, and we had an hour together. And he's an old friend and even colleague of mine, if I could claim such. And he's been interested in Dzogchen for many years, so I'm his advisor or expert on that. But I said, "How are you, Father?" And he could hardly talk or move. And he was in his 90s and dying from cancer and supposedly in pain, but he's not taking any pain medications. And I'm not recommending this to our listeners. I'm describing what this saintly meditation master and mystic was like. And he said, "Pain, yes, body. Sometimes God squeezes me." It was like, whoa, that was worth the price of admission or driving across the country. It depends on how you hold it.
Yeah.
Pain or God, sometimes God squeezing me. That's how close he was to his God.
Absolutely.
The pain was God squeezing him.
Yeah.
He was like, oh, thank you. Thank you, Lord. Thank you, Father.
Yeah, amen. And he would do that all the time. He was always coming up with those wonderful kinds of just right on the mark, hitting the point directly, and really quite extraordinary.
And that's how these things help us, which is why I mentioned this. And people wonder how, some people, they don't get the pleasure out of an analyzing and thinking about this. They wonder how it's going to help. And this directly helps with, as you mentioned, dukkha, or dissatisfactoriness and misery, or trauma and other things that afflict us, even like rage and resentment and so on. I'm going to wrap up, Ken, but I do want to say how wonderful it is to see you and be with you. And I've been on your podcast, and our listeners can find me there, and you're on mine now. You can find me there. And we have a lot to do together, and all who are listening are invited. If you're not already, leading the charge, start leading, waking up where you are and wake others up. It's a beautiful thing.
Absolutely.
Take the pillow off our heads and, look at the day. Get our heads out of the dark place that sometimes is stuck in. And open the heart, because it's a beautiful world. I just lost my wife, so I'm going through some things. But I'll tell you, as I always say, thank God for the Dharma.
Yeah.
Thank God for Buddhism. Even though there's no God in Buddhism, thank God for Buddhism. I think it's, saved my ass and saved my life and sanity. And not just the ism of it, but the wisdom of it. The internalization of that is what we need to work for. So I hope that this kind of talk helps all of our friends to seek, and not just to be a seeker and a pilgrim, which is important, but also to find, to be finders, finders keepers.
You're right.
Keep yourself well.
Right.
Absolutely. Don't try to keep temporary stuff.
You got it.
So wonderful to see you and hear you and talk. And
well, blessings to you, my friend. I absolutely love you.
I love you too, Ken.
Okay, buddy.
Take care. I look forward to seeing you in Denver one of these days.
You got it.
Bye-bye. One in the heart. Bye-bye.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. What would you like to get off your chest right now? Are you feeling lonely, unappreciated, or misunderstood? When you keep these feelings bottled up, they can affect you negatively. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest and work through whatever is weighing you down. It's a great way to increase your self-awareness, change negative thought patterns, and more. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/beherenow today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com/beherenow.